For this evening's talk, I'd like to speak a little bit about a particular Buddhist sutta discourse which we've been studying in the monastery the last little while, called the Samanyapala Sutta, the fruits of the spiritual life. And it's one of my favorite suttas, favorite discourses. And maybe I'd like to talk a bit about that this evening. Samanyapala Sutta features a king in the time of the Buddha called King Ajatasattu. Now the name Ajatasattu, Ajata means unborn and Sattu means enemy. So Ajatasattu means literally unborn foe. Which you might think is a slightly curious name to give your son. What should we call him? Fred? Jeremy? Perhaps? No, we'll call him the unborn enemy. Probably, there's a couple of Ajatasattus in ancient India, so actually probably maybe actually had a different connotation. It maybe had a connotation like the somebody, one who, against whom no foe is born, right? So it's something like the unconquerable one, something like that. It's probably the original connotation. But in Buddhism, it's come to have a bit more of a sinister connotation. And the story goes that while Ajatasattu's mother was pregnant, that she had a terrible dream, and as many bad omens and evil omens, and they got, of course, the prognosticators and so on to come and read the signs and the omens and so on, and they made the prophecy that the son would murder the father. And at that time, the queen had this, while she was pregnant, had this insatiable desire to drink the blood from her husband's knee. Right? So we all know that women, while they're pregnant, have these kind of strange, you know, things. And in the West, we tend to treat that as more or less a kind of curious kind of eccentricity. But in India, particularly in India, this was considered to be like a sacred duty, that the husband had a sacred duty to fulfill whatever it was that the wife wished for, no matter how outrageous it was. And so this has become like a trope of Indian storytelling. So anyway, she wanted to drink the blood from the husband's knee, and the husband was, of course, King Bimbisara. He's a very righteous king of Magadha, and he said, what do I care if my son wants to kill me and take the kingdom means nothing to me. And so he just took the sword and cut open his knee and let her drink the blood. So that was the pregnancy, right? And then after that, things got a bit problematic after that. Anyway, Ajatasattu was born. grew up, and there's many stories about him, but as he became older, he came and was the crown prince. He came under the influence of Devadatta. And I'm sure many of you have heard of Devadatta. It was like the Judas of the Buddhist story. And he was the Buddha's great enemy. And so when Devadatta wanted to overthrow the Buddha, he conspired together with the then prince Ajatasattu. And it's a very interesting story, because it says in order to persuade him, he used his psychic powers. Devadatta used his psychic powers and manifested in front of the prince in the shape of a young boy with a girdle of snakes. Somewhat curious kind of image, isn't it? So when he saw this, the king was filled with awe, and the prince was filled with awe, and then asked, said, whoever this is, to declare themselves. And then they showed themselves as Devadatta. And so after that, Jatasattu got great faith in Devadatta and supported him very lavishly and so on. And Devadatta said to him, we want to make this plan. I'm going to kill the Buddha and become the Buddha, and you can kill your father and become the king. Right? So I'm not quite sure how that was going to work in Devadatta's mind, actually. By killing the Buddha, you get to be the Buddha himself. But anyway, so Devadatta, I won't go too much into Devadatta's story, but of course he tried many times to kill the Buddha. First, and then he went to the Buddha and said he wanted to run the Sangha. After trying to kill him, he then went to the Buddha and said, okay, now I think it would be a good idea if you would turn over the running of Buddhism to me. And to which the Buddha memorably responded, I wouldn't even hand over the running of the Sangha to my two chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, much less to a glob of spit like you. That's just what it says. Anyway, Devadatta was a bit upset by that. And anyway, Devadatta then had many attempts to kill the Buddha, and they all failed, of course. One of his attempts to kill the Buddha was that he rolled a rock. At that time, the Buddha was staying on the what they call the Vulture's Peak, is a monastery, a mountain near Rajagaha. Those of you who have been to ancient India, if you go to the city of Rajagaha, it's one of the main cities where the Buddha lived. And the name Rajagaha literally means a king's holding. And it was obviously chosen for its defensive placing. And it's quite an amazing, basically a circle of hills, pretty much a complete circle of hills surrounding a central plain. And so obviously a very defensible position, and there's a lot of, you know, walls and so on, defensive walls built on the hills and things. And the Buddha used to stay on one of the hills there called the Vulture's Peak very often. And it's called the Vulture's Peak. You can see even pictures of it still today. There's one of the rocks which, when you look at it from a certain angle, it actually looks exactly like a vulture's head. And so anyway, the Buddha was staying up there and was coming down for alms in the morning, and it's a very kind of rocky hill, and so Devadatta sort of pushed down a boulder and tried to kill the Buddha with it, but it bounced past him, but a shard of stone hit the Buddha's foot and cut his foot. So the Buddha was being looked after in a monastery down at the bottom of the hill called the Ambavana, the mango grove. And he was being looked after by his doctor, who was a man called Jivaka. Now, Jivaka was the Buddha's doctor and was also the king's doctor. And he was renowned as being the greatest surgeon at those times. And he himself had a very interesting background, a very interesting story. he did his medical training in a town called Takasila, which was the main sort of town of learning in those days, up in northwestern India, in Pakistan. And his graduation test, right, for his medical degree, was his teacher said to him, okay, here's a cart and a horse. I want you to go out of the city of Takasila and drive around all day and bring back everything that is not medicine. Okay, so I want you to have a look at everything. Everything that's not medicine, you bring back in. So he left, drove around his cart all day, and came back with an empty cart. And his teacher said, ah, sadhu, 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 you've passed the test. Yeah? So this is a very beautiful story about the way of teaching medicine. And of course, very meant to have a very spiritual connotation as well, yeah. So what's everything that that's dhamma, yeah. Everything is a medicine for us. Everything is a teaching for us. So anyway, Jivaka was well known for doing some fairly outrageous medical procedures, including brain surgery and other things, and became the most famous doctor in the kingdom. And he would look after the Buddha and look after the monks and nuns who were sick, so much so that people would even come and ordain specifically so they can get free health care. Yeah. So anyway, when the Buddha was injured, he went down and stayed in this monastery, which was actually a piece of land owned by Jivaka, near Rajagaha, and so that where Jivaka could come and attend on him while his foot was healing. And by this time, the cycle with Devadatta had sort of run its course. According to the traditional story, the earth opened up and swallowed Devadatta because of the weight of his evil. And so that's just a kind of a bit of the background story. And when the Samanyapala Sutta opens, it's a very, very beautiful setting and very beautiful sort of piece of literature and piece of scripture. Because all of that very kind of lurid and kind of violent, kind of almost like pulpy kind of tabloid stuff is all kind of in the background. And what we actually open up with in the Samanyapala Sutta is King Ajatasattu on the roof of his palace. And it's a full moon night, just at the end of the rainy season. So you can imagine that at the end of the rainy season in India. And the dust has all been settled by the rain. Everything's very lush, very wet, and the sky is very clear. Yeah, the rain has cleared the sky and so on. It's not too hot, not too cold. And so it's the most beautiful time of year, and it's a time when the white lotuses bloom in the ponds. So there's Ajatasattu on his roof with all of his advisors and so on. And he says, "How wonderful is this moonlit night? How marvelous is this moonlit night? How beautiful is this moonlit night? How auspicious is this moonlit night? If only there could be some teacher or philosopher who could bring peace to my heart on such a night as this." So this is a very beautiful opening. Yeah, to that. It leaves so many things unstated. Yeah, but you have this king who has everything. He has all the power, all of the wealth, all the status, everything he could possibly want. Yeah, and yet underlying that somehow, why does he say this? Why is he still looking for that peace of heart, that one thing that he can't find? So this is the reason I find Ajatasattu to be such a powerful figure in the Buddhist literature. In fact, I think of all the people in the Buddhist literature, he's perhaps the most interesting, because he's very ambiguous. You know? Like the Buddha and the great disciples, they're kind of all good. You know, it's kind of hard to relate to them. You know, they're so perfect, and then you get the kind of the nasty guys like Devadatta and so on, who are like all bad. And so there's this tendency to put things in black and white. But Ajatasattu, He's very ambiguous. He's hard to pin down. He's very human. And so he has this kind of longing to find peace, but doesn't really know how to go about it. So anyway, he's sitting with his ministers, and each of the ministers suggests a particular teacher that he might go to ask and to seek peace of mind. And at each time, he just stays silent. Finally, Jivaka doesn't say anything. Jivaka himself is silent. And so Ajatasattu says to him, "Jivaka, why are you remaining silent? Have you got any suggestions?" Now, of course, Ajatasattu must have known that that the Buddha was staying in Jivaka's mango grove. Yeah? So he's dropping a pretty clear hint here. And so after all the other teachers had been suggested, Jatasattu wasn't interested. Finally, Jivaka suggests, why don't we go and see the Buddha? So Jatasattu says, okay. So they prepare this big royal procession. Thank you. Royal procession. 500 female elephants with 500 of Ajatasattu's wives seated on the female elephants. Yeah? Yeah? So all with the women going. And why did they do that? Well, according to the explanation, was because Jivaka organized it. And he knew that Ajatasattu was so fearful that he thought somebody was going to attack him. So he thought he'd feel safe if he was surrounded by all of his wives. And when they're going out to the mango grove, a very strange thing happens, because as they come near to it, they can see the pavilion, and Jivaka knows that the Buddha's in there with more than 1,000 monks, and they're sitting in the mango in the pavilion, and yet it's completely silent. And so this theme of silence always runs through this sutta. Very, very powerful theme. It's just silent. And Jatasattu is just filled with this fear. It comes up, why are they silent? What's happening? It's a trap. Yeah? He's leading me into a trap. And so he's filled with terror. And then Jivaka says to him, Ma Bahai Maharaja, Ma Bahai Maharaja, do not fear, great king, do not fear, great king. He says, go forward. There are lamps burning in the hall. One of the beautiful things about this in the original Pali is that the word for the lamp to be burning is padipa jayanti. And padipa is a lamp. But in Indian thought, in Indian imagery, the lamp is also means a guide. Yeah? To say that the lamps are burning. A lamp is also a guide. But also the word for burning is jayanti, which also is to... literally means to practice jhana. Okay, so the word jhana in meditation also means to burn, because it's like the brightness of the mind. So you could translate the same sentence, the lamps are burning, which is obviously what it means, but also the guides are meditating, yeah, in the hall. Yeah? So they say, go forward. And so he goes forward into the hall and he says to Jivaka, hey, he says, which one's the Buddha? And which is very nice, because it shows that, you know, like the Buddha wasn't sitting there, didn't have like a kind of big thing on top of his head and rays of multicolored light coming out of him and all of these kinds of CGI and stuff. He was just an ordinary bloke. And so Jivaka says, okay, that's the Buddha over there sitting. So he goes up to the Buddha and he looks at the monks sitting there very serene, incredibly serene and incredibly quiet. And rather than being afraid of it, and now I can see them, He's filled with such joy. And then he says, his first words are, if only my son, Udayibhadra, would experience such peace of mind. As the bhikkhus are experiencing now. And there's another little point in the sutta where it expresses this kind of emotion, which is in a sense a very normal emotion, one that we can all understand, yeah? We can all understand that we think of our loved ones and we wish that they will have this peace and serenity and so on. But the background story is that after Devadatta had instigated Ajatasattu to kill his father, he'd had his father arrested and locked up. First of all, he tried to kill him, and the father said, what are you trying to kill me for? And he said, I want to become the king. And he said, if you want the kingdom, why didn't you just ask? Here you go, you can have the kingdom, I don't care. I've been running it for all these years now, you have it. It's your turn. And so he took over the kingdom, but he was still, Devadatta told him that he couldn't trust his father, so he had him locked up, had him thrown into jail and chained to the wall. And then that becomes another whole kind of story. All of these are elaborated through all the Buddhist mythologies. One of the things which is not actually found at all in the original texts, but found in later versions, is the story of Bimbisara, the king's wife. Okay, so the king's wife, whose name I can't remember, was somehow keeping him alive. He was in his cell and chained to the wall and basically was being starved to death. But she would come to visit him, and she would always find some way to kind of smuggle in some food or something like that to keep him alive and bring him the things that he needed, to the extent that she would smear honey on her limbs, and then he would lick the honey off, and that's how he'd keep alive. And so apparently then Bimbisara's wife has now become the Bodhisattva, who's like the head of one branch of Japanese Buddhism. Okay, so there's a whole school of Buddhism now based around Bimbisara's wife because of her great devotion in keeping her husband alive. Anyway, so there are that thing's going on. Now, at the same time, Jatasattu's wife was pregnant and going to give birth to a son. And these two events were kind of proceeding apace. Until finally Devadatta convinced Jatasattu, he said, you know, you can't leave your king alive. He's going to be like a snake in the grass. He's going to get back at you one day, so you have to kill him. So he sent the men, he gave them the order to kill the king. And then he had, a short time later, two messengers came to him. And one messenger was from the women's quarters and came with, and he said, and came with the message that his wife had just given birth to a new baby. So he'd had his first son. And then they brought the son to him, and he was so full of joy and love to hold his baby son. Yeah, and he was just so filled with joy. And then the thought occurred to him, oh, this is how my father must have felt when I was born. Yeah? And so he was struck by that strength of a father's love. He was struck by it for the first time. And then the second messenger said, oh, we've just killed your father. Yeah. So he wanted to send the messengers just to say, stop killing him, save your father, but he couldn't. He's already dead. So this is all the background story to then that moment when Ajatasattu is in the hall with the Buddha and he says, may my son find the same peace of mind now that the monks have. And of course, the irony of that is that Ajatasattu's son later killed his father as well. So on and on and on it goes, yeah. This is like, it's like one of those kind of great kind of Greek mythic cycles and everyone's killing everybody and so on. But here's Ajatasattu and speaking with the Buddha in the hall, and he says, the Buddha discusses with him for a little while. And then he asks him, you know, have you come with a question? He says, ask whatever you wish. And so this is something which it's said in the tradition that this is the province of the Buddhas alone. That the Buddhas have the confidence to be able to say, ask, I'll answer you any question whatsoever that you put to me. And so then came Ajatasattu's question, which forms the framework of the sutta as a whole. And the question itself is a very simple one, which is that people who work in various crafts and occupations can all see a visible benefit from the work and the effort that they do. So they can find a sense of accomplishment in their work, they can earn a living from it, they can support their family, they can find happiness for themselves, and that they can use the money for doing charity and doing good things. So any normal occupation, you can see that benefit. But what's the benefit of the renunciate life? What's the benefit of the monastic life? Is there any benefit that you can show me here and now? So he wasn't interested in, you know, in the Buddha saying to him, oh, well, if you do this, you'll go to heaven or something like that. He wanted to show the benefits that's actually apparent here and now. So when he asked that, the Buddha then said, well, have you asked this question of other ascetics or other philosophers? And he said he had. And in fact, the group of six philosophers is a famous group of teachers living in the time of the Buddha, and these were the ascetics who the other ministers had advised Ajatasattu to go and visit. Actually, he'd already been to visit them, and he'd asked them all of his questions. And each one of them had not really answered the question properly, but they'd just taken the opportunity to propound their own system of philosophy. And so this was kind of obviously a bit of a dig at the philosophical systems and teachers which were available in ancient India. And I think it's quite a valid description of what tends to happen to a lot of philosophies and a lot of religions and so on, is that instead of speaking to the actual issues and the actual problems that people have, that it becomes just a platform for enunciating one's own views. So he says to the Buddha, can you give me a genuine, real benefit of this spiritual practice here and now? And the Buddha says, yes, I can. He says, okay, what is it? He says, well, here's one. And so Buddha's very, very skillful teaching, and he knows who he's talking to. So he says, starts out by saying, well, what would happen if you had like a servant who was working for you and who then went off and became a monk? Right? I mean, if they're a servant, if they're working for the, you know, king's worker, then the king will say, do this, do that, you know, go here, work here, do that. And they have to do whatever the king says. But what would happen if they became ordained, if they became a monk? And you say, well, what could I do? You know, I would bow down to them. I would respect them. I would offer them the requisites. And I would give them support and protection because this is my role as a king. So in doing that, then Ajatasattu was just fulfilling the normal role that a king would have in ancient India, is protecting and supporting the religious practitioners in his realm. So that's quite a very skillful place for the Buddha to start, because it's something that Ajatasattu can relate to. Yeah, it's not a particularly exalted benefit, right? You don't ordain or become a monk or a nun so that, you know, you can have people, kings coming and worshipping you, right? But nevertheless, it's something that Ajatasattu can relate to. We actually had this kind of bit of an issue around this in the Australia Day, because when we had various of the monks and nuns around Australia got to meet with Kevin Rudd, and when Kevin Rudd met my teacher Ajahn Brahm in Perth, he said to Ajahn Brahm, "G'day, mate." So this was. This is the greeting. Well, I don't know if you call Kevin Rudd a great king in that kind of sense, but anyway, he's the closest we've got, probably. And so I don't know what this means, but when he met me, he didn't say "g'day, mate," but he made Anjali like that very nicely and very respectfully. So I don't know whether that says anything. Maybe his minders had just given him some lessons on etiquette in the meantime. I don't know. Anyway, so... But that is, you know, that is something which does happen for those of you, you know, for those people who do ordain, is you get treated differently. And this is actually something which, I mean, I don't want to get into that topic now, but it's a major part, major sort of part of the psychological development of someone who's interested to ordain, because you really are put on a pedestal and treated very differently. So it's something that has to be treated with great care. It's something that's very dangerous. Anyway, so then King Ajatasattu says, "Sadhu, sadhu, that's wonderful. I can see that it's a benefit of the spiritual practice here and now. But is there any? Can you point out any higher or more sublime kind of happiness that's derived from spiritual practice here and now?" And the Buddha says, "Of course I can." And he then goes on to teach a very, very long teaching, which is called the Gradual Training. Now, gradual training is too long and detailed to go into here, but essentially it's a detailed description of the Buddhist training on what we call Sila Samadhi Panya, ethics, concentration and wisdom. And so at each stage of this, the Buddha points out the kind of happiness which results. So, for example, the keeping of precepts. The first precept is the precept against killing living beings. And so if one refrains from killing living beings, one abides with a heart that's full of loving kindness and compassion for all living beings, having abandoned violence. And doing so, you feel inside oneself a blameless happiness. So this is a very important part of Buddhist psychology and the Buddhist spiritual practice, is that keeping our precepts is primarily motivated by, as well as by just the wish to do good and the knowledge that one is helping others. But also, if there's an acknowledgement that by doing that and by acting in that way, it actually leads to an inner sense of happiness, which is quite tangible. So this is really the core motivation from a Buddhist point of view for keeping precepts and for acting ethically. It's not out of fear. It's not because, you know, you've got somebody telling you do this, do that. But it's because of an inner understanding that by acting in this way, that's what leads to happiness for oneself and for others. And so that teaching continues and talks about all of the different aspects of the path. And for example, it talks about the practice of mindfulness in daily life, that in every act, whether moving the hands or sitting down, standing up, lying down and so on, that one acts with a sense of clear awareness. And so again, acting in that way brings a sense of unsullied happiness to your act. The reason for that is that when you act in that way, and if we act with mindfulness in all of the things that we're doing, our mind is not stressed. The mind is not being torn apart and agitated. The mind is with whatever's happening at that moment. And in that, it finds a sense of wholeness and a sense of stillness. And again, other aspects of the path, for example, of contentment is another one. And this is a very beautiful phrase it uses in the suttas. It says, just like a bird, when it flies, would just take its wings with it. And so too, when a bhikkhu, a monk or nun, wherever they go, they would take just their bowl and their robes with them. So there's that aspect of like the lightness of life, the lightness of things. It's caused by contentment, and again this leads to a sense of unsullied happiness. And so as this course of this goes on, that happiness that you experience becomes deeper and the practices become more refined. And then it goes to the practice of meditation itself and the abandoning of the five hindrances. Again, not time to go into the five hindrances in detail here, but with each one of the abandoning of the hindrances, these are sort of afflictive or negative forces in the mind, desire, ill will, doubt, restlessness, sloth. And with each one of these, the Buddha gives these very beautiful similes. He says it's like like somebody who's very sick, lying in bed with a fever, not able to move, and then later on they would be freed of that fever. They would be freed of that illness and they'd be able to get up and do what they wanted. Or else it's like somebody who's in jail, who's not able to walk where they wanted or do what they wanted. And then later on they would be freed from that jail. Or else it's like somebody who's crossing a desert. And then at the end of the journey they'll come to the oasis. So these are like, that's that feeling of being released from the five hindrances. A very interesting thing about this is that sense of freedom and freedom from the five hindrances is not anything in itself. Like that's the state of health is not actually anything. Like when somebody gets out of their sick bed, maybe they do completely different things. You know, one person goes for a walk in the bush, another person goes to the movies, another person catches up on their emails or whatever. What they're actually doing is quite different. But the commonality is that freedom from illness. Yeah, so this is that the freedom itself is not anything. Yeah, and so we're always mistaken if we're looking for freedom as being a thing, as actually being something that we can give a positive description to. Actually, freedom is just the lack of and the ending of these various kinds of limitations and bonds. So with the freedom of the mind from the five hindrances, and then it goes into developing the mind in jhana, and to deep samadhi and so on. And then the various kinds of higher knowledges, and ultimately the the realization of the Four Noble Truths and the abandonment of all kinds of attachment. This is just a very, very rough and crude summary of these teachings in the Samanyapala Sutta, which each step of the way is said to result in a kind of happiness which is higher and more sublime than the one before. And each step of the way is adorned with these very beautiful similes, like the similes for the four jhanas. It talks about like a lotus which is born and grows underneath the surface of the water. And the happiness and the bliss of meditation are soaking through the whole body. And so it's very typical of the kind of imagery and ideas which we find all the way through this sutta. And then finally it reaches up to full enlightenment and the abandoning of all defilements, and the Buddha says that there's no happiness which is higher or more sublime than this one. And so of course King Ajatasattu rejoices in the Buddha's teaching and goes for refuge. So even after committing the terrible crime of killing his father and so on, he still wants to go for refuge. And perhaps the most extraordinary moment in the whole discourse is where Ajatasattu actually confesses his crime to the Buddha. And he says that he'd killed his father, a righteous king, for the sake of gaining the throne. Imagine that. Imagine the king saying, he actually said sorry in front of everyone there in public, and just confessing that crime. Imagine what they're going to do to him. All kind of, because they all would have known. And so when the Buddha then gave his usual saying, when somebody confesses, then the Buddha would accept the confession and say that for anybody to confess and to want to make amends is growth in their spiritual practice. So then the king left. And after he left, the Buddha said to the monks, "Monks, the king is doomed." Because, of course, being one of the, what they call the five anantarika kamas, the five acts with immediate retribution, is killing one's mother, killing one's father, killing an arahant, wounding a Buddha, or causing a schism in the Sangha. And these five things are said to guarantee a rebirth in a very unpleasant place next time. So no matter what the king did, he couldn't escape that doom. So this story, teaching on the Samanyapala Sutta, to me is a very beautiful teaching on so many levels. But particularly for me, it's so important to see that appreciation and understanding of the purity of spiritual practice in the midst of such strife and violence and conflict. And so the Buddha wasn't reacting against all of that violence. He wasn't having grudges and resentment against Devadatta and Ajatasattu for trying to do such harm to him. But even in the midst of that, he came out with this incredibly beautiful and serene teaching. And so there's this kind of image, to me, this very, very kind of beautiful image when I try to hold this in my mind of this ideal of this spiritual life, which is really like a like an oasis or like a gem in the midst of all the turmoil of the world, that it can be held, it can be something which retains its purity and retains its beauty no matter what happens. And for myself, even though my own spiritual practice and spiritual development is very small, but one thing that I've learned from my time as a monk is that any time when I've actually practiced these things as the Buddha taught, then I have actually experienced those results. And that happiness which the Buddha talks about in there is not just a mythology, it's not just a literary, trick or anything like that. It's an actual psychological reality. And if we put that into practice, and no matter how much we are like Ajatasattu, no matter how much we are conflicted and torn by different kind of worldly pulls this way and that way. If we're able to find that space within ourselves to practice and to put into practice these teachings, then we will also experience that result, we'll experience that fruit. There's nothing mystical about it, there's nothing irrational about it, that we don't have to wait for some kind of gift to be bestowed on us, we don't have to wait to be kind of endowed with some lineage or transmission or anything like that. It's just very simple, it's how the mind works. If we practice and live our life in the right way, then we'll have the results of those kinds of happiness that the Buddha was talking about. So this is my little talk for you this evening, and I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions. Yes, Manushi.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, obviously the basis of it is the sense of gratitude for our parents, which is something which can never be repaid, and which is almost kind of infinite. I mean, we wouldn't be here without them. It's not we sort of view. It's not that you just owe them for this or that, but it's just the gratitude for being itself. So, I think you know that's obviously the basis of it. I mean, in some cases. It's understandable. I mean, there are abusive parents and all of these kinds of things, and in some cases you can understand why somebody would want to kill the parents. There's also other cases like euthanasia and so on, which are actually quite common, when the children have to make a decision about whether the parents to be, pull the plug. Personally, I don't think in that kind of situation, I don't think that that's what that rule was talking about. I mean, that principle was talking about murdering your parents. It's not talking about putting them out of their misery.
So to kill one of them will have this devastating effect on you. Yeah. Not thinking of it so much as a punishment, just as a logical result. Even if the parent has been terrible and in some way might deserve to die, nevertheless it's still going to have such a devastating effect if you are the one who has to do that.
This might be a fruitless kind of metaphysical speculation, but if this is one thing I never understood, if karma is intentional action, then with an act like that, where the consequences are based on the kind of fact, then would it be that one has to know that it's the parent or an arahant to have the intention to do that? Or would the consequence be the same without that knowledge?
Yeah, the sutras don't actually say that. No, it's not a fruitful question. It's a fruitless question. I think it's quite a good one. As far as I know, the texts don't actually clarify that point. Generally speaking, if you're doing some kind of karma, both things are involved. Okay, so there's both the intention, but there's also the object. So, for example, if I think I'm going to murder somebody. And I actually go to kill them, it turns out they're just a model or a dummy or something like that, then that's not karmically murder, even though my intention was fully to kill them. So certainly if they weren't actually your parents, so that would affect things. But that, in a sense, what the thing with karma is saying is that because karma is like an ethical determinant, but it's not the only factor involved. Yeah? So Buddhist causality is always complex and involves many factors. So karma is the thing that pushes the moral colouring of it in one direction or another, but the extent of that is determined by a multitude of factors. So if you didn't know it was your parent, if you're kind of like in the Oedipus story, for example, then I would say, personally, I would think that wouldn't count in that situation.
But he was doomed.
Oedipus?
Yeah. I mean, the consequences were quite doom-like.
The consequences were doom-like, yes. Yeah, very much so. But he actually found redemption in the end.
Yeah.
In a kind of peculiar kind of way. So, yeah. But that's...
And not just on him, but then on the next generation to continue his own.
Yeah, yeah. But that's, you know, that's the Greeks. I mean, they were into that kind of thing. But, yeah. But, I mean, in a sense, if you take that seriously, if you take the doom part of it seriously, then how intentional is it if he's predicted that there's a prophecy that he's going to do it, can you actually have intention if it's already inevitable?
There is in that your story as well, the prediction.
Yeah.
Quite similar in a way.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
My question is, since you said that, was does the Buddha usually make predictions of
that? Well, in that case, it wasn't the Buddha making... Oh, sorry, prediction about him going to hell, the Tathagata. He doesn't usually, but I think that might be the only case where that happens. I'm just trying to think. It's certainly not common. But it's not that common of people who go and, you know, getting their mum and dad in it either. So.
Is another way of looking at it? Occurred to me at the level of suffering one generates to others. So if, let's say, Marcha killed me, I realize at the point of death, you know, feeling enormous grief and pain, to realize that someone who is laughter actually, you know, kills you. With Buddha, it's a different, and with Arahants, it's a different thing. It's creating suffering not to the Buddha and Arahant, but actually removing that potential, you know, of them to help others and remove suffering of many others. So we could look at it from that perspective.
Yeah.
Yeah. The amount of suffering that one generates.
Yeah.
I have a question about mechanics of, might be the right word, of reading this sutra if you didn't have the background story. Because there was a part of you were telling the story before you gave all of the background. And you got to the point where he was in the pavilion and said, I have my son here, this peace of mind. And because there wasn't all of the background, I thought, well, that's a very compassionate thought, rather than selfish in that sense. So,
but I still think it's still compassionate, you know, it's still genuine love. Yeah.
So maybe that's not exactly it, but when you get more of the story, you realise that there's a dirtiness in there that if you just read that sutta, you may not see it.
The sutta is very, very subtle because it's hinted at in these things. When a Jatakatri says, oh, is there someone who can find peace for my mind? Yeah? It doesn't actually tell you that he's full of turmoil and everything, but there's just that hint. And then the same thing when he's hinting, oh, if only my son could find that same peace. But the darkness of it is really only brought out right at the end when the Buddha says that the Jatakatri is doomed.
I was taking all those points quite differently, in that he was saying domain, saying, I have everything I need, but I don't have this one thing. Not that I have created mayhem, both of us. So I just thought it was a sense of, I understand now that everything I have isn't what I need.
Yeah, but that's true. But I think that those two things are not. They're more a matter of degree, you know. I think he's a very kind of dramatic example of the same kind of turmoil and which we all have, you know, because we've all created suffering around us because of the bad choices that we've made.
Mm.
Yeah, but you're right. I mean, it's a perfectly valid question in the sense that you see, when the sutta was formulated in the way that it was now, right? In terms of the historical background, now traditionally the suttas were formulated in the first council. Leaving aside questions of the literal historicity of that, now according to the Theravadan version of that, Ajatasattu sponsored the first council. Okay? So it's still very immediate and very fresh for them all, right? So they obviously all would have known that story. Yeah? So it's very interesting again to think of the fact that the sutta was phrased in that kind of way when actually everybody knew, you know, more or less all of the politics and shenanigans that were going on in the background.
It also occurred to me about the gravity of the killing one's parents, looking at it in a broader perspective in the animal kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually, it's really transgressing laws of nature in a way, going below animal level. Do any animals, you know, kill their parents? I mean, parents can kill their offspring, but...
I think they do.
They do?
Yeah, I think they do. Don't quote me too much on that, but I think that there are...
Very primitive species.
No, but I think I think some of the even primates and others do as well. And I think that cycle... You have this cycle in a lot of human cultures of the regicide, the periodic killing of the king.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically as the king gets older, he's killed, and so this is Jatasattu kills his father, and then he eventually gets killed by his son. Actually, it was endemic in ancient India and very common around the world as well. But you do, I believe, find examples. Basically, the idea is that the head male in certain kinds of sort of animal societies, the head male is like the alpha male, is the protector and the head is basically the warrior of the tribe. So as they get older, they're no longer able to do that duty, and their sons will challenge them. And eventually the son will beat them, and they might not die, but they'll usually maybe be weakened and cast off and then go away to sort of
yes,
fade away.
So I guess he descends by doing that to in human form, descends to animal level.
Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely, you know, even down to modern times, the Rajas in ancient India the standard practice was that you sent your sons to the border regions to be governors of the border regions, yeah, for that exact reason. Yeah.
Why did the Buddha say that he was doomed when he had confessed?
Yeah.
Did that count for anything? I mean, you know, that story of that mass murderer.
Angulimala, yeah.
Yeah, he killed, you know, whatever number it was.
Yeah.
And yet was still brought into the...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the place, you know, the...
Well, that's
he even had the intention of killing his mother.
Had the intention, but yeah, but managed to refrain. I mean, that's...
Why did he come out? Why did he say that he's doomed?
Well, that's this...
Not quite as much forgiveness.
Yeah. It's not a judgment, but again, according to the classical Buddhist teachings, and, you know, whether this is actually the case or not, I can't say, but the classical Buddhist teaching is always that there's these five acts which will inevitably result in you getting reborn basically in hell or in a very bad destiny. And they include killing your mother, killing your father, and so on. So no matter what you do apart from that, no matter what the atrocities that you do, you've always got some chance of escaping that kind of rebirth. But if you've done one of those five, then that's it. Doesn't mean that the positive acts and so on that you do won't have any fruit. Of course they will, but they'll just have any fruit later on. So that forgiveness which the Buddha gave and the encouragement for him to do good and so on will have fruits in this life and also in future life, but doesn't change the fact that he's headed downstairs. Yeah.
So none of us have killed our mothers or fathers or kings.
Yeah.
So that character who killed that large number.
Yeah.
This portion. Not to kill.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
If karma is said to work in a similar way as, you know, money coming in and out of the like bank account, for example,
mm-hmm.
then when you said one is trying to kill somebody, and that person turns out to be the parent of that person, but, you know, he or she doesn't know that person
mm-hmm.
is the parent,
mm-hmm.
then you said that maybe the result is probably not as undesirable,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I call it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And surely, for example, we say one knows that, you know, his or her parent
mm-hmm.
Is killed, and then after that he has a great remorse,
mm-hmm.
then surely that's a kind of discount as well, isn't it, in a way? Previously, for example,
if you didn't know at the time that they were your parent, but you found out afterwards.
Yeah.
Like Oedipus, for example, killed his dad and didn't realize it and then found out afterwards. Yeah.
And then, like, the actual.
Yeah, look.
Himself, you know, it turned out that he was a parent, but then.
Yeah.
The other one.
Yeah.
For example, if you know his parent was killed, but then after that, you feel the remorse.
You feel the remorse and stuff. Who can say?
With the other one, it's not that different.
It's not that different, no. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you can, if you want to go into it and into the subtleties of it, you can see that there are still fine differences there. But, I don't have psychic powers, so I can't say this person's going to go to hell and this person's not, and I can't see really what the particular karmic effects of those are in any kind of direct sense, so I can just sort of say what the suttas say. But what's interesting to me from, say the Oedipus story, is that in a sense that's pointing to this like cusp or this change in a human moral perception, which is found in a lot of mythology between where the ethics of things are no longer physical but relate to intention. Okay, so in that case he's done a physical act of killing somebody, and then his the moral that he has to deal with or to tussle with was the disjunct between his actual intention and the physical act, and so emerging from that is this kind of sense of ethical action as being something which is related to your intention and all of the complexities that involves.
The reference you made before to the exercise, you know, and that I'm just remembering the part in your book where you talked about that, the form of sacrifice, that the king gets sacrificed at a certain point, and that seems to be necessary to the cycle of power continuing on.
Yeah.
Because in a way, what seems different about this story that you've told tonight and Angulimala's story is that Angulimala is not a king. Angulimala is not bound up in that sort of cycle of worldly power. He's able to leave behind his life as a murderer and then really go into the Sangha and become a monk.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas this king, it's like he's too caught up in that whole cycle of sacrifice and power.
Yeah.
That would be another way of reading why he's doomed, despite the fact that he has this appreciation of the life of the Buddha and a desire for that kind of peace, but still one step removed. He wishes it for his son rather than himself.
Absolutely, yeah.
He's not going to be able to be freed from it.
Exactly, yeah, and that's very much so. And that's reflected again in other passages found in the suttas and so on, where there's one just little isolated passage where the people of Rajagaha are kind of whinging things, life was so much better under the old king, you know. So he obviously was, you know, a bit harsh. And then in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta where he suddenly wanted to attack the Bhajans, so he's developing this militaristic policy. So he's obviously his violence and so on hadn't ended. You know, he wasn't like completely converted. He probably thought Buddhism was a good idea and stuff, but certainly he was still very, very much in there. Yeah.
I have to go back to the thing point I made earlier, based on what you said, and my first hearing of "I wish this for my son" was more from that bodhisattva sense of wishing everyone else would get there to enlightenment, wishing that for everyone else before yourself.
Mm.
Might be a nice reading.
In a good mood. One particular teacher, you look at everything, but they think
just whatever, yeah, whatever. That's my experience. Is whatever that I've been able to actually practice properly, it's always led to that kind of happiness. Yeah. So one more question, because it's getting a bit late.
So I wanted to ask the benefits in instead of unkind thought, and you mentioned about being free from hindrances.
Of course, yeah, of course.
So you actually experience the freedom from the hindrances, you know, like you can still experience that if you're not going forward, isn't it?
You can, of course, you can freedom from all kinds of suffering. You can realize any time, and you can haven't gone forth, you can still have just as much. But that's also slightly different from the freedom of the hindrances as such, which is like the five nivarana. I mean, that's a more sort of profound meditative freedom. But again, you know, it's not bound up with going forth necessarily. Yeah. But it's just in that particular sort of teaching framework, that's how it's encapsulated within that whole kind of thing of going forth and then developing the various stages of practice. It's not meant to be exclusive in that sense. Yeah. It's more like an archetype or a paradigm. He's sort of presenting kind of the highest picture of the spiritual life, you know. And so like somewhere to something to aspire to. Yeah. Okay, we should.
This is actually a very, very stupid and unimportant question, but I'm really curious. From scriptures, it is always said that the Buddha has shaped, shaped head like the other monks. Why people quite rely the images of head with a bit of a bun on top of the head? Is there a symbolic meaning of it, or whatever?
Well, there's a symbolic meaning for it, because you can have a symbolic meaning for anything, right? So you can always read a symbolic meaning into it, so it's meant to symbolize the Buddha's wisdom and so on. In the original scriptures, it talks about the 32 marks of a great man. It says he has an onhisa. And that's an onhisa, whatever an onhisa is, okay? So no one really knows, I think, what that actually originally meant. And as far as the curly things on his head, there's another one of the marks of the great man is that all of the hairs in all of his paws turn to the right.
Okay.
Their hairs in the paws all turn in the same direction.
Are they different marks of the great woman?
Yeah, that's a controversial point there, I think. That's a bit of a controversial point there, yeah. So, which I probably shouldn't go into right now, but in any case, I think that's where they all curl around in the same direction. So I think it was an attempt to, part of it is an attempt to depict that particular mark, where they kind of curl around in the same direction. But, yeah.
It also says that his tongue can reach his forehead or something, is that right?
I'm not quite sure where this is leading, but yes, it does. Yeah, and he can lick his own ear holes as well. So is that a faith in these things that some people decided to have faith in the Buddha? Anyway... We did actually have a discussion of that in a sutta class a couple of weeks ago. So anyone who's interested in that can have a look at that. We have a sutta class on the Brahmayu Sutta. It should be uploaded sometime. Yes, the 32 marks of a great man. Perhaps more to be understood in a... Well, the 32 marks are basically the only real significance they have in the suttas is because they were fulfilling a Brahmanical prophecy. That's basically it. So it was kind of a means for converting Brahmins who otherwise would think themselves too superior to Buddhists, so that they kind of, by having the Buddha as the fulfillment of their own prophecy, exactly the same technique is used in the Gospels where Jesus fulfills a whole bunch of Old Testament prophecies. So I'm not quite sure what these marks mean, and some of them are clearly incoherent. They may originally stem from a Babylonian source, but I'm not really sure. Okay, so we should probably finish up here from the sublime to the differently sublime. And Renee, do you have any announcements?
Thank you for your attention tonight, and thank you everyone for being involved. In terms of announcements, Bhante will be holding a metta meditation retreat between the 1st and 5th of April, which is the Easter weekend. We've also got some information over at the table over here, and there's some reading material there as well. This evening is free of charge. However, if you would like to leave a donation for the teaching, the Dana bowl is also on the table where the little candle is. Are there any other announcements that anybody has, please?
Okay.
So for anybody new who may not know, we run the session every Friday night, and everyone's welcome. Please tell your friends and invite them along.
Thanks so much. Okay, so that's from the Japanese space. Sangha.